The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I've been teaching a group of people this week in a non-residential retreat, and there's been a kind of a theme that's come up a few times around how our experience is shaped, the conditions that create what's happening right now, you know, all of that kind of flow of conditioning, and then how our relationship to that shapes what comes next for us in our experience. So that's the theme I wanted to explore this evening, this shaping quality, the way that both we are shaped by our circumstances, by our environment, and that how we are in relationship to that shapes our mind further. And so to start this or to explore this, I want to bring in a teaching from the Buddha that kind of looks at essentially what is shaped. You know, what is it that is this human experience? That the teachings of the Buddha really emphasize the experiential aspect. And so while there's a lot of shaping that goes on, a lot of different kinds of conditions and causes that affect how we are and who we are, genetics and things like that, the main piece that the Buddha was interested in and pointed to as a place where we could begin to kind of change the direction of the shaping is within our minds and our bodies, within the experience itself. And so that's the kind of emphasis here. And so the first piece that I want to explore is what the Buddha talked about as the experience. What are the components of our experience? And he talked about this in different ways. So there's not just one way to think about the components of our experience. He offered different ways to think about it. But the one I'd like to look at tonight is, it's kind of like five, you can think of them as processes, or five aspects of experience. And looking at what our human experience is, we can divide up our human experience in different ways. One way that we could divide it up is by the sense doors, seeing, smelling, hearing, tasting, touching, and then in the Buddhist understanding, we also add the mind in there as a sixth sense base. So that's one way to divide things up. But the Buddha had this other way of dividing things up that is a little more unusual in a way, where he looked at some key processes at work in our mind and in our body. And so the first of these is the body. You know, this is one of the processes that goes on. This is a big part of our experience, the physical realm. It's the sensation level of experience. It's not, you know, so, you know, just right now thinking about what you're experiencing physically, when we look at the actual physical sensation level, it's along the lines of pressure, vibration, pulsing, heat, coolness, tingling. That's how the body communicates with us, that level of sensation. And we sometimes think that the body is, you know, we might think, you know, okay, my thumb hurts or my foot hurts, and we think that they're talking about the body, but the thumb or the foot are kind of their concepts. There's an area of the body that is the thumb, but what is physical about this? The thumb is not a physical experience. I'll put it that way. The thumb is not a physical experience. It is an idea or a kind of a collection of sensations, and we overlay the idea of thumb on top of that. And so what actually is the sensation of thumb or hand? Hand's pretty easy to check into just right now, letting your attention rest in your right hand. You know, what is that experience? It's not hand. It's pulsing. Maybe stiffness. Warmth, vibration. So that's the That's the body level. That's how the body experiences things, and that's what the Buddha was pointing to in the body, in terms of what is available to be known. So much of what we actually think of as physical is actually more constructed in the mind. Even the experience of whether something feels good, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, that is understood in Buddhist psychology to be a creation of the mind. And actually, I understand it is the way that current neurobiology understands pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, that it is creation of the brain. It is mentally constructed. It is not in the physical sensation. It has to go through a process through the brain before it gets understood or interpreted as pleasant or unpleasant. And so this aspect of pleasant, unpleasant is another one of these areas of that the Buddha kind of highlighted. So he highlighted the physical realm, and then in this particular list of five, he had one physical and four mental processes or types of experience in the mind that he highlighted as, you know, these are worth kind of teasing apart and being curious about. And so the feeling tone was another one of those. And that is the simple experience of whether something is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And every single sensation in our experience, every bodily sensation, every sight, every sound, every smell, every taste, every touch, everything that goes on in our mind, thoughts, emotions, mind states, they all have they're connected with this feeling tone. So, you know, some physical sensations feel pleasant, other physical sensations feel unpleasant. We understand certain sights as pleasant, others as unpleasant. And we can also begin to recognize that the pleasantness or unpleasantness is not in the thing seen or the thing felt necessarily. Maybe seeing is an easier way to understand this, because you know, when we understand or think about what actually the eye takes in, the eye is taking in form and color. That's what's appearing on the back of our retina, is just form and color. There's not actually a person on the back of my retina. Well, there's the image of what I am interpreting as a person on the back of my retina. But the idea of person is born in the mind. And so, you know, form and color is pretty neutral. Form and color is pretty neutral. But so when we think something is pleasant or unpleasant in the field of sight, it's usually because we have overlaid a concept on that, and we think the concept is pleasant or unpleasant. And so this is another area of that the Buddha pointed to, is this the area of perception, of recognition of experience. So far we've got the body and these feeling, the experience of feeling, and now the Buddha brings in another process of perception, of recognizing experience. This is a big one for us. This one is how we navigate the world. From the time we're born, we start taking in sensations and sights, sounds, smells, taste, touch, and we learn through repeated exposure. We have, you know, we kind of learn that, oh, this kind of thing, that kind of shape or that kind of thing means this. And so we begin to, and we're told, you know, our parents are talking to us continuously and giving us names for these things. And so we begin to learn to associate concepts with our physical experience. So this is the realm of perception. This is the area of how we recognize what's going on in the world. This is a really important part of our mental experience, and it's a way of how we navigate the world. We can kind of almost think of it like a shortcut. It helps us to know what's going on around us without having to figure it out every time. So, you know, I can sit here and immediately, it's like it takes no effort at all for me to see this room and know there's walls and windows and chairs and cushions and people, and it's no effort. It's not a lot of work to do that because of this process. You know, I don't have to sit here thinking, okay, what's out there? You know, I don't have to do that. So this process of perception really supports us, and yet what often happens along with that is that, you know, so the process of perception, in a very real way, what we are experiencing is a creation of our mind. You know, we are taking in form and color, pitch and tone in the ear, and putting it all together into a tableau that we understand as being what's happening out there. And that tableau is a creation of our mind. It's hard to kind of grok that, but in a very real way, it is what we are seeing. It's like when we are looking out at the world, what we are experiencing, we're connecting with the world. It's like it's all mediated through our senses and our mind. And so we can't really know exactly what's going on out there. We know that we are experiencing what our mind has created. Only we usually forget that. We usually forget that what we are experiencing is what our mind has created. And we kind of think that our eyes, our ears, our senses are kind of like cameras and microphones, and they're recording everything that's going on. But that's not actually how our system seems to work, because our system seems to be designed to kind of filter in things that seem relevant to us and filter out things that don't seem relevant to us. And so we are not really taking in the entirety of experience. And so this is a place, it's kind of a danger for us. It's useful, this perceptual process, but it also is misinterpreted and misunderstood. When we are engaging with the world, thinking that we are seeing things accurately, seeing things exactly as they are out there, then we are, we are caught by some delusion. We are caught by this view that we are seeing things as they are. Anais Nin had this great quote that is very evocative of this. She said, "We don't see things as they are, we see things as we are." And so very much the way that we take in the world, this perception, is shaped. It's shaped by our history, our conditioning, what we have been taught to appreciate, what we've been taught to deny. So how we take in the world is not a neutral thing. It's very actively shaped. And that shaping quality, so this is the fourth area the Buddha pointed to, the shaping has to do with our, and this word is a little, it's a little funny in some ways. It's the Buddha pointed to a whole big area of our mind called mental formations. So this is a lot of what goes on in our mind. So the Buddha talked about the body and the feeling and the perception are mental, and then this mental formations, which are basically all of these qualities of mind that have kind of a what we could call an onward rolling force to them, and that they're kind of associated with an intention or a kind of an impulse to do, that there's a lot of mental activities of mind that are not, I mean, feeling and perception are more, they are kind of shaped by our history and our conditioning. They have been shaped. But it is the mental formations that shape the next moment. They shape how we see things, how we feel things. And so these mental formations are a whole slew of what we could call emotions, That's one category of the mental formations. It's not just emotions, though, in this category. So the mental formations includes emotions frustration, anger, confusion, greed, pride, arrogance, a whole host of what we could call reactive emotions. It includes beautiful emotions, wholesome qualities of mind, love, compassion, wisdom, patience, joy, delight. So it's and we can kind of get a sense with all of these emotional qualities that they're not just like they don't just arise in us and then stop there. Often when these emotional qualities are arising, they affect how we want to engage, what we want to do, what our choices are. And so this is this place around choice and intention, how we engage, what we do. That's the big kind of piece of this particular area, that these qualities of mind are the motivators of our actions, of our choices. And so this is really where the shaping piece lies. I'll come back to this. This is the big piece I want to kind of explore in more depth tonight. And then the fifth of these five parts of our experience that the Buddha pointed to is a very simple kind of just. It's just a simple, not simple, but. It's just the capacity of our mind to know experience. I mean, it's kind of an amazing thing. It's simple in that it's just there's a sight, and it contacts the eye, and then there's a knowing of that. And so it's like the light of awareness or consciousness. It's a simple thing in that it's not doing much other than just. With every experience, there's a sensation in the knowing of it. There's a sound in the knowing of it. There's a body sensation in the knowing of it. There's a mood or an emotion and the knowing of it. And so this knowing quality is another one of these pieces that the Buddha kind of highlighted as a component of our overall experience. And it's a key component of our overall experience because without it, we don't experience anything. So the consciousness is kind of the ground out of which we experience anything, and then the feeling and the perception help us to orient to, what's pleasant, what's unpleasant, and what we recognize, and then our mental formations respond to all of that, and so the mental formations are. The responsive and active part of our mind. They're really what shape our experience. And so as I said, that there's a lot of these different volitional formations. The emotional component, the emotional realm is a big part of that. But then there's some other states of mind, some other things that in the West we wouldn't necessarily think of as emotions, but they're put into this category of mental formation because they shape the mind, because they affect how we relate to things. And so that's qualities of mind like wisdom and concentration. Mindfulness is one of these qualities of mind that has this shaping quality. And so we don't think of these as emotions, but they have this similar kind of, when they're present in our minds, when concentration is present in our minds, it affects how we act. When wisdom is present in our minds, it affects how we act. When compassion is present in our mind, it affects how we act. And so so the shaping, the way that this works is, I think we can kind of see this with, let's think about the emotional realm, because that's probably the easiest place to see this shaping. So, we all have a kind of favorite habitual tendency, tendencies of orientation to the world. For me, that has historically been a kind of an aversive approach to the world. So I'll walk into a room and I'll orient to what I don't like. And okay, how can we fix that? How can we make that good? How can we, you know, so it's a kind of orient to the things that that I feel need to be fixed or changed, like that. And so this quality of aversion, just as one example of a mental formation, has been shaped. You know, it has been something that has been conditioned from my experience. Like, I didn't come into the womb thinking I'm going to be aversive, I'm going to, like, you know, orient to things that I don't like when I come out of the womb. Like, that was somehow that the way that my experience was shaped, based on what happened to me, based on how my parents were, based on school, based on culture, based on what I saw on television. So everything kind of shapes us. And we each have our own individual shaping that has happened, that has created our habitual ways of responding to the world. And so these qualities of mind that shape our choices, that shape our future, are themselves shaped. And yet, fortunately, it's not hopeless. I mean, you know, you might think hearing that, it's kind of like, well, if all of that is shaped, and those things happen, and then they shape the next thing, it's like, well, where is there any choice in the matter? But this process, we have a process that goes on in our minds that we are very fortunate to have as human beings, and it is this self-reflective capacity. It is that we can know what's happening in the present moment and recognize what's happening as this is a helpful thing that's happening or this is not a helpful thing that's happening. And that kind of present moment recognition, and this is mindfulness, this is this quality of mindfulness, that present moment recognition can feed into choices about how to shape the mind. And so it's not just that things from the past shape what's happening in the present. How we are relating to that, what's happening in the present, also shapes the present. So it's that's the piece where there's a possibility for the shaping things in a new way. So if it were simply that the past shaped the present and then what's happening in the present shapes the future, if it were just that, then there wouldn't be much possibility for change. But there is this extra feedback loop in the present moment. And so when we know and recognize, when we see what's happening in the present moment, there's the possibility to choose differently. So if mindfulness is not happening, we've been shaped by everything that's going on, and what's arising in the present moment is the habits that have been shaped based on our families and our culture and everything that we've learned in the past. And if we're not aware, if we're not mindful, those habits are going to be what chooses our response to this moment. And that will tend to perpetuate and condition the same kinds of habits and patterns that we've had from the past. And so that's kind of, if we're not kind of orienting and bringing in this question of, well, what's this experience like right now? Just a simple question that we look at in our meditation. It's like, what's happening right now? How does that feel? What's going on? What's it like to be a human being experiencing anger, for instance? You know, if we ask that question, then there's the possibility. I mean, first of all, our mind begins to recognize that that experience has a particular quality that doesn't feel very good. And we also have perhaps seen in our lives that when I've acted on that, it hasn't gone very well. in my life. And so if we see it happening in our minds, if we're mindful, aware of it happening in our minds, there is the possibility. Now, the flow and the habits of conditioning are a very powerful force. And so, you know, the mindfulness gives us an opportunity to kind of intervene in that force and choose a different direction. And so when mindfulness is arising in the present moment, there can be a new choice made, a different choice made, and not simply following the habitual conditioning from the past into the future. So that's kind of how the whole shaping process works in a way, and why being mindful is so important. So the mindfulness, we start to, you know, look at these shaping factors. We get familiar with what's going on in our experience. And it's really useful to begin to recognize, okay, so this is the experience of anger in the present moment, or this is the experience of love in the present moment. What's that like? And in the experience of that, we start to see how not only does that anger shape the future, but it's also shaping the entirety of our experience right now. And so the shaping power of these mind states, you know, it affects not only the mind, but it affects all these other areas that the Buddha talked about of our human experience. And so, for instance, when anger arises in our mind, it affects our body. We know that, you know, we know that it kind of pulls, you know, we get a tension and a tightness inside, a heat and a pressure maybe arise. Those are physical sensations that are associated with anger. It can affect our face even. You know, an expression on our face, I talked about in the guided meditation, the feedback loop between the expression on our face and the quality of our mind. When anger arises in the mind, it tends to distort our face into a particular angry expression. And so it shapes our body. These mental qualities shape our physicality. It shapes our feeling. You know, when we have anger arising in our mind, we tend to be experiencing unpleasantness and also orienting to notice unpleasantness. And so it's kind of shaping that, you know, that when we're angry, I remember on one retreat, I was watching my mind, and I was as many times I got to watch my mind and see anger in my mind. I was doing walking meditation and was working with this anger that was arising in my mind. And it was a late winter night, and we were all walking inside, so the room was pretty crowded, and that added to my aversion, kind of the claustrophobia of so many people in the room. And at one point I was doing the walking meditation and noticing every pass, I was like, okay, yep, anger's happening. There's the experience of anger, feeling the tightness in the jaw, the contraction in the body. And I turned around at the end of one walking path, and there was a pair of shoes at the other end of my walking path, and they were not my shoes. And my mind just exploded in rage. Like, who put those shoes at the end of my walking path? It's like, you know, those shoes in any other situation probably would have just been, oh, shoes, you know. But the mind was angry, and so when it landed on those shoes, the feeling that arose in connection with that was unpleasant. So the anger shaped actually the feeling of the experience of that seeing. So the feeling tone is shaped. Sometimes the perception can actually be shaped. If we have anger in our minds, we may be interpreting somebody else's expression or somebody else's words as being attackive, you know, as being attacking us or being dismissive of us or not being respectful of us. So how we perceive or how we take in what somebody else is doing or saying can be affected by that anger. And even what we know, you know, even the the kind of the orientation to the world. When we have a particular, we can think of these mental formations, these shaping qualities, it's almost like filters in our minds. And these filters tend to let certain things in and don't let other things in. So what we become aware of, what consciousness meets, is affected by the quality of our mind and what we're doing, how we are. And so if we are angry, we may not take in that somebody is, you know, doing something kind for us. Even something as simple as an agenda. An agenda is a form of a mental formation, you know, a kind of like, okay, I'm going to look for this. That can influence what we see and what we don't see. So there was a famous study done, and some of you may have heard about this, looking at it, and thing that I'm describing right now from the Buddhist perspective of mental formations affect what we take in, how we become aware of things, what we become aware of, what we don't become aware of, has a present-day psychological name called selective attention. And so they were doing some studies on this quality of selective attention and looking at what things do people notice and what things didn't people not notice. And so they did this study of having people watch a video that people were playing basketball in the video, and they were asked to count the number of times that the basketball passed between the people in the white shirts. And so that was the task of the research project, or that was the task that the participants were told was the task of the research project. And so people watched the video, counted the number of times the basketball passed between the people in the white shirt, and could pretty much give the answer, the correct answer of how many times the basketball passed between people. But then there were a few people who, after watching the video, you know, kind of were like, was there like a guy in a gorilla suit in the video somewhere? And indeed, there had been a guy in a gorilla suit that walked right through the middle of the basketball players. And it was like, not like he was like in the background or anything. It's like right in the middle. They had to pass the basketball around him. And some good number of people did not see the gorilla. I think about 50% of the people do not see the gorilla. I recently watched some of these videos, and knowing this kind of thing, you can see the gorilla. But this particular one that they watched, they said, "Yeah, okay, so you know, we can even fool you if you know the gorilla is going to be there. So watch this video, and you know, count the number of times the basketball's passing, and you know, okay, maybe the gorilla is going to walk through, maybe not, but." See if you can, you know, just see what happens here. And so that all happened. And then, you know, I saw the gorilla. I could count the number of times the basketball was passed. And then they threw in another thing. They said, and did you notice the color of the curtain changed behind them? Like, no, I had not noticed that. So the mind, being focused on a particular task, it will take in information relevant to the task. This is useful. And yet, it is a place where, you know, kind of like this is a pointer to that. We think our minds are taking in the information like a camera, but we are aware of some things and not aware of other things. Our minds are selective, and the agenda in this case is the mental formation that is choosing out of the experience what we know, and then there are other things that we don't know, that consciousness does not become aware of. So even an agenda can shape this. Now, this isn't necessarily a problem. You know, this is a way that our system can support us and help us to navigate the world. If we have an agenda, the fact that our mind can take in certain information and ignore other information that's not related to the agenda is useful. So it's not necessarily a problem. The problem comes in when we think our mind is seeing everything. And we go to a police station and report, no, the color of the curtain did not change. I would have seen that happen. No, that person, or yes, that was the person. No, that other person was not there. I did not see them. You know, the whole way that our minds work is not very reliable for taking in kind of random information that's not in line with what is relevant for us, for whatever our agenda is. And so this shaping quality, the problem here is when we think our minds are accurately receiving experience and we behave in that way. Yes, I would have seen the curtain of the color change. And in fact, some not insignificant number of people in this study who watched this video did not see the gorilla. They showed the video back, and then they saw the gorilla, because when you are looking for the gorilla, you're not going to miss the gorilla. And some number of people, not insignificant number, I can't remember the exact number, maybe in the 10 to 20% of people who did not see the gorilla the first time said, that's not the same video. That has to be a different video because I would have seen the gorilla. And that is a dangerous quality of our minds, that we can actively deny that our minds are not going to see everything, not going to take everything in. So this quality of mental formations, anger, love, agendas, shape what we receive, what becomes conscious. And then these mental formations tend to shape more of themselves. So when we engage with, when we follow through on anger, when we follow through on frustration, it tends to kind of create the conditions for more of that to happen. Likewise, when we follow through on love and when we follow through on compassion, it creates the conditions for more of that to happen. The Buddha framed this with a simple phrase that I use a lot. Whatever we frequently ponder becomes the inclination of the mind. And so this is a key for the shaping quality of the mind. This is a natural law, kind of the way our minds work. When we frequently engage in aversion and anger and frustration, the mind is creating the conditions for that to happen more often for us in the future. It's like that our mind believes in a way that those are the qualities or those are the things that will help us to get what we need, get what we want. Right embedded in these qualities of greed, aversion, is a form of delusion that has us believing that the greed and the aversion are how we will be happy. That aversion, the belief embedded in aversion is, if I can separate myself from this thing in whatever way, whether I get myself out of there or obliterate the thing, I will be happier. And so that's what's embedded in the aversion, is that view, that belief. And so the more we act on that aversion, and there is a little bit, the feedback loop that we get here is that when we act on that aversion, we get rid of that thing, or we act on that greed, we get that thing. There's a little bit of relief, a little bit of feeling like we're in control, like we figured it out. A little bit of, okay, things are okay right now. So we get a little tiny hit of pleasant. We get a little tiny hit of, that's the way for happiness. So it feels like we get a little hit of happiness in that way. But what our mind doesn't understand is that happiness is very fleeting, because almost as soon as that happiness has arisen, the mind is on to the next thing, and the next thing that it has to control or fix or change or get rid of. And so it becomes this like squirrel cage, hamster wheel of how to how to engage. Well, I gotta get the next pleasant thing. I gotta get rid of that next unpleasant thing. And we get these little hits of, oh, okay, that makes me feel good, but oh, where's the next one? It's like as soon as that happiness arises of getting something or getting rid of something, it starts to fade. Sometimes it fades more quickly, sometimes it fades more slowly, but it does fade. And so this like cycle we're on is trying to find happiness with these fleeting moments. And so that's what the delusion is connected to. And in a way, that delusion of this is going to bring me happiness, it's kind of like also connected to the belief, well, I guess this is as good as it gets. You know, if I can get this thing, get rid of that thing, if I can try to string along these set of pleasant things and getting rid of unpleasant things, that's as good as life can possibly get. Because aversion and greed cannot fathom that there's another kind of happiness that's possible. And this is what the Buddha found and discovered, is that there is a different kind of happiness. A happiness that comes not from trying to endlessly grasp and control things, but from aligning ourselves with this reality of this flow of changing experience. Of not trying to hold on to or push anything away necessarily, but you know, what's happening in this present moment, this is just a continual changing flow of experience. And as we begin to kind of align ourselves with that, there's a different kind of release, a kind of an ease or a peace that comes with that alignment with the truth of this moment. And you know, it's funny because that sounds like, and I said this earlier, it sounds like it might be passive. We think of like, yeah, I'm okay with things as they are, as being, I don't have to do anything to change it. But this being okay with things as they are is more of an alignment with, this is how it already is. This is what's already here. And then as wholesome qualities meet that, you know, as the greed, the aversion, the delusion, the habitual ways of getting rid of, push, pull, as those begin to fall away, then more wholesome kinds of relationships to experience come up. There's a compassionate relationship to experience and a joyful relationship to experience, a connected relationship to experience, a wise relationship to experience. And these qualities of mind also shape our experience. They make choices. They inform us to act in a particular way. And so, for instance, when we might see somebody being, you know, hurt or harmed, that there's a, you know, there's that could result in a kind of an aversive reaction and an angry reaction and a lashing out against the person who's harming that person. That is one response to that. There's another response to that, which is compassion, both for the person who is being hurt and wanting to stop the person who is hurting that person. You know, so the compassion there could be compassion both for the person who is being hurt and for the person who is hurting. And the action wouldn't just be, oh yeah, there's suffering going on, oh, things as they are, that's what's happening. The action when compassion is arising would be, stop, that's not appropriate. That should not be happening. It might even be a physical kind of pulling somebody away or kind of separating somebody. It might have a physical action. So this is the kind of thing that the aversion, the anger, the hatred can't fathom that there's a different relationship to seeing this situation. And so, you know, we begin to be aware of how the anger shapes our mind, the love shapes our mind, the wisdom shapes our mind, the compassion shapes our mind, and we start to see there's a different way to respond to situations. And that there will be action. There's a little bit of trust that has to come in to this, and this shaping that I'm talking about now is essentially as we learn about these wholesome qualities and the way that mindfulness can help to change the possibility, making a different choice, that compassion and wisdom allow us to respond rather than react with a connected quality of the heart rather than a hardened, separate quality of heart, then our system begins to recognize that the wholesome qualities, it's like in the moment, the experience of feeling the wholesome quality of compassion is so different than feeling the quality of anger and hatred. And our system begins to kind of like, yeah, that actually feels like more resonant with well-being. That feels resonant with a different kind of happiness. And so the mind begins to shape itself in a new direction. And it begins with mindfulness. It begins with the curiosity about observing all of this habitual conditioning. You know, all of the stuff that comes up in our minds that we're not trying to stop these unwholesome qualities from coming up in our mind, but we are interested in, rather than just following through on them, it's this interesting middle. The Buddha called it the middle path. You know, it's like. It's not repressing these qualities, these reactive qualities of mind, but nor is it acting on them. The middle way is, can I know this quality of mind? Can I be curious about what is it like to be a human being that's feeling this reactivity right now? That sounds almost like nothing. When we first hear it, and certainly when I first heard that, I thought, well, what good is that going to do? But it is very powerful because it opens the possibility for our mind to begin to recognize, you know, before we started paying attention to these reactive states, before we had this kind of understanding of maybe not acting on, but neither repressing either, just feel what's happening. You know, we just assumed, we bought into that view of that reactivity, that it's going to make me happy. But as soon as we start being mindful of it, as soon as we start being aware of those states of mind, our mind begins to understand, oh, actually, this is not the way to well-being. And so our mind begins to choose something else. And so this middle path of neither repressing nor expressing creates the conditions for something completely different to happen. And we begin to taste some of these qualities of compassion and wisdom and generosity and patience and tranquility and peace and ease. And then as we experience those and take those in, and we act out of those become more what shapes our future. So there's a few minutes for any comments or thoughts or reflections, if there's anything you'd like to offer, share, or ask.
Andrea, I can see how thinking about our emotional experience, our state of mind experience in terms of evolution, I can see how we become happier when we are generous or offer compassion, because that's part of the social cohesion that promotes our survival. What I don't understand yet is how to explain the increased happiness that comes from letting go, from not wanting, in terms of Darwinian evolution and promoting survival. Have you ever wondered about that?
Well, I mean, the question about, I mean, if you're thinking about it in terms of what will promote survival of the species, what will promote survival of the species is greed. The question that's embedded in that is, you know, that there's something particularly valuable about that survival of the species. That there's an assumption built into that. And, you know, ultimately, when we think about it, it's like the entirety of everything on this planet at some point is going to be gone anyway, you know. So there's just there's a little assumption embedded in there. But what I'd say is that, you know, in terms of looking at this, and there's actually a very interesting book that you might be interested in, since you're interested in this kind of evolutionary aspect of what's going on. It's called The Self Comes to Mind, by Antonio Damasio. And he looks at the evolutionary basis for this sense of self, you know, how it was built and constructed. And what I'd say is, like, you know, in the Darwinian evolution, the kind of the way that works is like, okay, yep, amoeba-like movement towards food, away from noxious chemicals. You know, it's a very simple kind of mechanism. And that's the basis of our, you know, pleasant, like wanting, unpleasant, not liking, not wanting. But then he points out that what happened in human beings, like in the simple creatures, it's a very direct, it's like very physical, that move towards pleasant, away from unpleasant. There's not a lot of choice in the matter for those beings. You know, that's just the way those creatures are designed. As human beings evolved, what Damasio points out is that the way the nervous system evolved was that, and I hope I'm getting this right, I mean, read the book, was that it you know, in the simpler creatures, the movement to protect the organism is like right at the edge of the organism. It's like the entirety of the organism is protecting itself. In the human nervous system, it's like the complexity of our system required an additional layer. And he said it basically required creating a map of our organism in the brain. And essentially, the movement to protect the organism, like in the single-celled creature, the creature is protecting the actual organism. But in our system, the mechanism to protect our organism is not actually protecting the organism. It's protecting this map in our brains. That's how our system is designed. And so it's already a step removed from the actual physicality.
From the mere physicality, yes.
And in that step removed from that physicality, there's a layer of possibility of choice. Like, oh, this thing is pleasant. Do I have to go there? Delayed gratification actually might be beneficial. You know, so there's many layers in there for humans to make choices, to just not just go with what's pleasant and away from what's unpleasant. And that's, I think, where
long-range thinking is.
Exactly, right. And that's, I think, where this question that you have can be looked at. And when we see, you know, what the Buddha taught, when we see that the choices that we're making around, you know, get this thing, get rid of that thing, are creating stress, essentially. And then what the Buddha pointed to is the possibility of letting go actually reduces stress. there's a way in which our organism wants to move towards reduced stress. And that's a biological imperative, the movement towards reduced stress. And yet, the original way we've gone about it, trying to reduce stress, has had all kinds of concepts and views and ideas that kind of keep us at a level of non-stress, I mean, of somewhat stress. And so when our system kind of begins to see this other way that the Buddha pointed to, essentially what the Buddha pointed to was a complete release of stress. And so that's, you know, that's why it kind of works in a way, you know. But I would just look at your experience. I mean, what happens for you when you release wanting? Does it feel less stressful? Sometimes, sometimes not. But to look at when it doesn't feel stressful, what else is happening there? There's usually some other place of holding. So, yeah, I just curiosity about that. It's a great question.
The self comes to mind. Is that
the self Damasio. Comes to mind is the name of the book. Antonio Damasio. Yeah.
Damasio.
Yeah, and it's time to stop, unfortunately. Yeah, absolutely. So, thank you all.